Okay, welcome everyone. So the speaker today is our own Xin Yu. Xin Yu has done very interesting work recently on the neutrino flavor conversion in accretion disks around a compact object, and also this magnetic dissipation when you collide Offen waves. So Xin Yu, please take it away.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Thank you, everybody, for coming. And it's nice to present my work before the people at PI. So mainly today, I will talk about my two recent papers, as Juan has just mentioned. In the first part of my talk, I'll be talking about this neutrino fast flavor conversions in the post-neutron star merger accretion disks. And in the second half, I will turn to a different topic and where we proposed a new mechanism of fast dissipation of magnetic energy through the collision of Offen waves. So if anybody has any questions in my talk, please just interrupt me so I can stop and address the questions. Okay. So let me just move forward. So the first part of the talk about the neutrino fast flavor conversions in the post-merger disks. And all these problems comes from the first multi-messenger observations of this gravitational wave event, 1708-17. And to the left is the joint observation of the two LIGO, Hanford-Livingston, and the Virgo detection shown here. And because the Virgo has no detection, provides a good localization of such event in the sky, and almost all the telescopes on this planet are pointing to that direction. And immediately, a few milliseconds after the gravitational wave, a short gamma ray burst was detected. And then following that, we also observe the X-ray emissions, ultra UV emissions, optical, infrared, and also radio emissions about a month later. So all these emission mechanism is kind of in good agreement with this kilonova emission model proposed mainly by Brian Metzger and many other people. So in this picture, so first we have two neutron stars in spiraling and merging through the at the inspiring phase. And they start to produce the gravitational waves. And at the onset of the collision, that's what we observe for the gravitational wave signal. And immediately after that, the central object becomes either black hole or have a massive neutron star. And an accretion disk is formed just outside. And this collision also produces a short gamma ray burst. Then later, because of this hot, dense, material in the disk starts to undergo nuclear synthesis, mainly through the R processes, and the decay of such heavy elements starts to produce the emissions, starting from a bluer component with the neutron pool with electron fraction larger than 0.3, and turning into a red component with low velocity and neutron-rich smaller YE ejectors. And later with the radio emission is also proposed, which was also detected months after the GW170817. Okay. And as I just mentioned, these in the post-neutron star disk, the environment can be very hot and dense. Yeah.
So in the previous slides, you also have this UV component, where does it come from?
UV component. So mainly that's the what we call the blue component, right? It's turning from a high frequency to the lower frequency case. So the emission going from a higher frequency to a lower frequency, that's turning from bluer to more redder.
Okay, it says neutron precursor.
Here are the neutron precursor. Well, this is something still is a problem here. Sorry. You're seeing this UV here. Sorry, I didn't quite catch. This is something that's just people propose. There could be some precursor emissions falling before the GRB or whatever, but this is still debatable. And also even the source of the blue kilonova is still not very clear yet.
So this precursor, is it before the merger or after the merger?
So before the merger or after merger? I'm not sure here, but there could be some precursor emission even before the merger. There could also something after the merger, but I'm not exactly sure about that. But here, just these people, this is the plot I'm taking from the Rodrigo Fernandez and Brian Metzger, and they just say there are what will be the possible emissions there. And these red kilonova is definitely what we observed.
Okay.
So maybe I can quickly jump in, sorry to interrupt, just to add on this. So this neutron precursor is essentially this an idea that goes back like 5 years or so, which people hypothesize is due to essentially free neutron decay. So it might be that, and this is observed in some of the numerical relativity simulations, that there's a tiny tail of very fast ejecta of say 50, 60, 70% at the speed of light, which may lead to essentially decoupling of neutrons so that they essentially don't see each other. So essentially what happens is instead of these neutrons clumping together and forming the R process and leading to the sort of vanilla type blue and red kilonova, these neutrons actually don't find each other. And so they just decay freely. And that happens on a timescale of 15 minutes, which is the decay timescale of a free neutron. And that leads to sort of heating on these very early timescales after merger. So 10 minutes, 15 minutes after merger, that could lead to UV emission. But sort of more modeling is still required to understand this better.
So this high-speed ejecta, is it from pre-merger or post-merger?
That's post-merger. So this is essentially material that originates in the collision interface between the two neutron stars, where essentially this strong shock ejects material with sort of a power law distribution up to very high velocities.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks, Daniel. Mm-hmm. So let me just continue. So in this disk environment, it can be very hot and with a temperature up to a few MeV and with density up to 10 to the 12 grams per cc. And in this environment, the neutrinos are kind of copiously produced and with luminosity up to like 10 to the 52 to even 10 to 53 Earths per second. And they are almost optically thick, close to the central neutron star or the black hole. And these high energy neutrinos can participate in the nuclear synthesis and can change the final results of the nuclear synthesis through the weak interactions. And in the previous simulations, for example, as Daniel has done, they kind of usually took the simple approach, approximate these the neutrino as following something like a leakage scheme. And the only full radiative transport for the neutrino radiation field is done by Miller et al. 2019 using the Monte Carlo method. However, all these studies neglect one important physics, which can be quite interesting here, which is the neutrino fast flavor conversion. So for example, in the neutrino in the flavor eigenstates as the basis, the density matrix for the neutrino can be written in this way. So we have a trace part and an antisymmetric traceless part. So this is in the basis of the flavor eigenstates. So the diagonal term is just for each flavor of the neutrinos, and the off-diagonal term will indicate the mixing or the oscillation between the different flavors. And the neutrino will evolve under this Hamiltonian, which I wrote here. The first term is just a vacuum term, which corresponds to the vacuum oscillation of the neutrinos. And the second term is the neutrino matter interaction, mainly between the electron neutrino and the electrons. And the third term is the neutrino self interaction. So once this neutrino self interaction takes into place, and in the equation of motion, we can find that this can lead to exponential growth of this diagonal term, the big the off diagonal term, the big S, which indicating a fast conversion between the different flavors. And the growth rate for this exponential growth of this off diagonal term is of the order about like 10 to the 9 inverse per second, corresponding to the time scale of a nanosecond. So this mainly the flavor conversion between the different flavor of neutrinos can be very fast. So much, much shorter than any, almost all the dynamical timescales we can think of. So in the previous study, mainly people doing some, perform some post-processing. For example, on the left, I show some results of the core cap supernova. And the color here indicates the growth time scale for the off diagonal term. On the right is processing done for the neutron star merger remnant. And as you can see here, so almost inside the neutron star, inside the neutrino sphere indicated by the red line, there's no fast flavor conversion, but just outside is almost ubiquitously activated almost everywhere. So in my study with Daniel, we performed a general relativistic MHD simulation of the neutron star post-merger disk, including the neutrino radiation transport. And the neutrino radiation transport, we coded into the code following the general relativistic M1 method developed by Shibata. And the code is adapted from Luke Roberts et al. 2016. And in this formalism, we trace four species of neutrinos, electron, anti-electron, and muon and tau neutrinos are grouped into one single species. And for each species, we divide them into six energy beams uniformly separate, uniformly distributed between 0 to 60 MeV. And just let me say a few bit more words about the M1 method, if people are not familiar with that. So in the fluid dynamics equations, if we integrate out the distribution function to get the moment, we will find that the evolution of the nth moment will be usually depend on the n plus one moment, which is the closure problem. And for the M1 scheme, it just treats the radiation field as a fluid field and assume that the second moments of the radiation field is given by some proposed analytical relation from the first moment. So that's why they can close all these equations and evolve the radiation field. Okay. And besides that, we also include the neutrino flavor conversion dynamically into our simulations. And we took the following approach. So at each time step, we calculate the maximum growth rate omega corresponding for the off diagonal term for each grid following the dispersion measure approach by proposed by Izaguirre et al. 2017. And once this growth rate is below, is very large, or the time scale is below 10 to the minus 7 second, we assume the fast flavor conversion is activated and will very fast leads to equipartition among neutrinos and antineutrinos separately. So in other words, once the criterion is met here, we artificially by hand set the equipartition among this electron and muon tau neutrinos and between the antineutrino separately. And in the simulations, we start with equilibrium torus of a relatively massive one, about 0.7 solar mass around a 3 solar mass black hole at the center. This black hole is assumed to have spin 0.8 and very low electron fraction of 0.1. And we follow the evolution up to 400 milliseconds. And in order to comparison the effects of the fast flavor conversion, we compare two simulations with and without fast conversion activated. So the run with fast conversion activated, we name it FC, and the run without it, we name it NFC. Okay, so let's dive deep into the simulations. So as we can see that in this initial equilibrium disk, we'll experience a kind of very initial stage of relaxation, and then slowly relax to some quasi-steady turbulent state. and where MRI will be initiated and it enables the matter to be accreted onto the disk. That's forming a quasi-steady turbulent accretion disk. And on the left, I show this the maximum of magnetic field strengths in the disk as a function of time. And for three different resolutions we've tried, so there's also a convergence test. So we can see like this initially, these almost after like 10 milliseconds, the MRI is will produce saturated magnetic fields about like 10 to the 15 to 10 to 16 Gauss, and the saturation level are consistent between this high and medium resolutions, indicating our numerical simulations is convergent. And on the right, I plot the accretion rate as a function of time. And we can see like this peak accretion rate is kind of very high, very close to one solar mass per second. And this is well above the R process threshold. So in this situation, the weak interaction will become important and R process will be activated.
Okay. So can I ask how thin your accretion disk is, or maybe that's your next
thought? How thin you can kind of see here is like, this angle is about like 45 degrees something. This is a torus.
But does it remain like that? This is, okay. So it's not very thin then.
It's not very thin, but I can show you, well, I didn't include, I put that in my supplementary slides. I can show you this evolution of this density field, the movie for it.
Okay.
Later, yeah.
So the typical scale height, so once neutrino cooling sets in, will be roughly like 0.1 or so. So it's actually fairly thin. Initially it's like geometrically thick, but then as cooling sets in, it gets geometrically thinner.
All right. So this is just the initial condition.
Yeah, that's just the initial condition. Yes.
I see. Good. Thanks.
Okay. And let's see how this disk evolves over the time. So here I plot two snapshots, one at 30 milliseconds on the left, and the other is at 300 milliseconds on the right. So let me explain a little bit. So the top half of the plot indicates shows the density field as shown by the color. And the lower half of the plot is the growth rate, the logarithmic of the growth rate. And overplotted that, the contour indicates mainly the neutrino free path for a specific energy group of anti-electron neutrinos lying between like 20 to 30 MeV. So at early time, we can see that almost the inside the neutrino sphere, there will be no fast flavor conversion as shown here by the right, by the white region. But just outside, the growth rate is very high, close to like 10 to the 10. Indicating something very short of fast flavor conversion almost everywhere, just outside the disk. This is in agreement with this post-processing done by Wu et al, where they look at the disk also like around a few tenths of the millisecond. But later, when this disk gets become neutrino cooled and the disk gets thinner, we see that even inside the disk, it becomes unstable to the fast flavor conversion. But however, the net growth rate also decreases over time. So on the right, you can see like almost everywhere, neutrino fast flavor conversion is activated.
Mean three paths, yes.
Mm. Yeah.
Free streaming path.
Okay.
Free streaming.
Sorry, I was.
Okay. So, and here is a comparison between like our two different rounds with and without neutrino fast flavor conversion. So on the left, and both snapshots are taken at 300 milliseconds. It's kind of fairly late. And on the left is when the neutrino fast conversion at activated, and on the right is the NFC run. And here I shows the snapshots for the electron fraction YE. So at the very inner disk, the YE is kept at very low, through this self-regularization process proposed by Daniel. And we can just, by eyes, we can tell like that when, without the neutrino fast flavor conversion, the ejector becomes more neutron poor and the YE is getting higher. And on the left, right, we can see this YE is getting much lower. And also this, we also observed a gradient, a radial gradient of this electron fraction YE. And this this gradient is also more prominent without the fast flavor conversion. And to understand this, mainly let's just have a look at this neutrino, total neutrino luminosity for this run without a neutrino fast flavor conversion. Because in this environment, the electron and anti-electron neutrinos are more copiously emitted than the other species, as we can see here. And once fast flavor conversion turns on, we mainly set the equilibrium between the among the neutrino species. So in other words, we kind of effectively, we reduce the number densities of the electron and anti-electron neutrinos and convert them into the other species, which almost does not interact with the matter and does not change the electron fraction of the ejector. So in this case, because the reabsorption, especially of these anti-electron neutrinos will be reduced. So the weak interaction will produce an ejector with more neutrons as shown by the left plot here. So, and then we just took all, unbounded tracer particles in our simulations and inputted into the SkyNet calculation for the R process nuclear synthesis. And we can see that due to the reduction of the high energy anti-electron neutrinos, the, high energy, the lanthanide abundances will be increased with the fast conversion turning on. So, right. So if we have a very large amount of the anti-electron neutrinos, that will suppress this kind of a lanthanide production and this third peak here. But when we turn on the fast flavor conversion that reduces the anti-electron neutrinos, they can restore these values back very close to the solar values as shown by the dotted red line, red dots here. Okay, so that's more or less about this, this work. And let me jump to the conclusion. So first we performed the almost the first GIMHD simulations with the neutrino flavor fast conversion included dynamically. And these post-merger disk will have a high accretion rate. The post-merger disk we are choosing has a high accretion rate close to one solar mass per second and shows a gradient of YE indicating an early bluer kilonova emission that's turning into the redder emissions. That's probably something happened in the real case of the GW170817. And with fast flavor conversion included, it is able to boost the up-processed lanthanide abundances back to the solar values. And this effect will also be important, for example, in the core cap supernovas and other similar processes. Okay, so that's more or less the end of my first part. Let me just pause a little bit to see if there's any question here.
Yes, Xinyu.
Yeah.
In the NFC, do you simply turn off the neutrino self interaction?
Yes, it's something like that.
Okay.
Yeah, so this neutrino field is just emitted and we just follow its radiation field. So there will be nothing about this fast conversion on it, yeah.
Another question is, I remember there was some discussion about the neutrino collective oscillation. Is it related to or similar to the faster conversion here?
Collective, yeah, there is something similar, But let me see. I don't quite remember what exactly they're saying. The eclectic oscillation can also be due to the neutrino and the matter interactions.
Right.
But here we are doing something very specific for this neutrino-neutrino interaction induced fast conversion.
Okay.
So can I ask for how long do you simulate? How many orbital times does the disk
rotate? How many orbital times? So this, let me see this. Well, we simulate this disk up to 400 milliseconds.
Mm-hmm.
So this is much longer than the viscous time scale for the accretion disk.
Mm-hmm.
So let me think of what is the orbital time scale, orbital GM over R. So it is a 3 solar mass black hole.
Right.
Yeah, so I don't get my numbers here. So GM over.
I don't have it off the top of my head.
Yeah, but okay. I think that should be much smaller. Yeah.
Sorry, what are you saying? Someone's
several milliseconds or 10 milliseconds. I don't know.
Okay, so it's 40 orbital times. But you say it's even longer than the viscous time?
Yeah.
Okay. So I guess I'm just thinking that, do you think there's a stable accretion? Is there some sort of a cooling instability that happens or not?
We don't see any cooling instability here, but the accretion rate is plotted here, which seems to be a quasi-steady state.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Yeah, let me turn to the slide, just show you how my disk evolves. So on the left, this is my density field.
Mm-hmm.
So right, as the neutrino cooling turns off, also the DSA is getting thinner.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But does the thickness kind of asymptote to some number, or does it just keep getting thinner? I guess that's the question.
I think it's getting thinner and thinner just because it keeps cooling by the neutrinos. Yeah, okay.
I don't know. I mean, this question of cooling instability, I think at some point Daniel and I talked about it, and I don't know if there's been any development on that, because I mean, it is a question for for accretion disks that are electromagnetically cooled.
Yeah.
But I don't know what is the status of that with neutrinos. That are there. It is. I guess you guys should see it if it's there. But I do wonder whether it's a question of time or scale as well.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Right. That's a good point. So yeah, I remember we discussed this some time ago. So we have not looked into this. I think in the meanwhile. So I think there are probably two things. So one is that these disks are cooled differently than the photon cooled disks, because here these disks are cooled from the mid plane, while photon disks are essentially cooled from the corona. So there's sort of this inverse cooling.
So why are they cooled from the mid plane? I thought it's optically thick to neutrinos, but.
Because neutrino emission is proportional to density and temperature to a sort of high powers. So it actually follows the density field. And so it's mostly cool from the midplane.
Aren't these optically thick? I mean, the neutrinos are scattered. I mean, you treat it as a fluid, but I assume because the mean free path is very short, right?
Right. So initially there are some optically thick regions, but then as the disk sort of starts to cool and then also starts to exchange angular momentum and viscously spreads, then actually these sort of optically thick regions disappear over time. So it's only really initially that you have an actual optically thick.
I see. So I mean, then there wouldn't be any problem. So I can't.
Yeah, exactly. So one would have to go to even higher accretion rates. So Jinyu has like simulated now like 1 solar mass per second. So you would have to go to even more extreme cases to see any of such cooling instabilities. And those are probably unlikely to happen in neutron star mergers, because this is probably so we sort of deliberately chose this model here because it kind of marks the most extreme case you could have in a post-merger disk, roughly. Much higher accretion rates than this are probably unlikely to occur.
Okay, great, thanks.
Thank you. Okay, any other question about this? Okay, so let me turn to the second part of the talk. This is my work with Andrei Bilobardov and Lorenzo Cerroni, and we've spent a long time on this, for a few years actually. So mainly the problem we are interested in is that how you can efficiently dissipate magnetic energy into the particles that can power the emissions. So especially in very strongly magnetized systems like in the magnetosphere of the magnetars, black hole corona, and the jets, and pulsar wing nebula. So these perturbations of the magnetic field will produce alpha waves, right? And for example, some processes like the very fast magnetar flares and the black hole corona flares may require a very fast dissipation of the magnetic energy to account for the very short rise time. And the previous study have suggested that either these dissipation takes place either through a turbulence cascade or through the magnetic reconnection. So for example, here there's a few examples. On the top left, this is something proposed to be happening in the magnetar giant flare, where the perturbed the energy is injected into the magnetosphere in terms of the alpha waves. And alpha waves kind of interact through nonlinear interactions and get dissipated into the particles, form this kind of the fireball as proposed by the Thomas and Duncan. On the right, this is creating black hole corona. And we can see like here, this plasmoid is formed and which will trigger the magnetic reconnection. So the lower left is the pulsar magnetosphere, where people nowadays usually think of this Y point where the magnetic reconnection takes place is responsible for some kind of the pulsar emissions. To the lower right, that's a kind of fairly new things where it's by Yaji and other people. They're saying that if you eject, just excite some alpha waves in the close field lines, it can become terry unstable when it hits the equator, and then we'll eject the plasmoids along with the relativistic ejector, and they try to use that for the fast radio burst model. And inside these strongly magnetized systems or magnetized systems, usually people describe them through the magnetohydrodynamics, where the scale of interest, the length scale of the interest is much larger than the plasma scale. So here the plasma scale refers to both the plasma gyro frequency and the skin depth of the plasma. So this, in that limit, the dynamics can be well described by a large scale effective theory, which is called magnetohydrodynamics. And for the MHD equations will require the two conditions to behold. The first one is the magnetic dominance. The other one is the vanishing of the parallel electrical field. In the strongly magnetized limit, and the MHD equations will reduce to something called the force free electrodynamics. In that case, people just assume these particles will follow the field dynamics with a vanishing Lorentz force. And in all these situations, the fundamental
Did we lose Jinyu?
Yeah. Froze. Yes. Maybe we can wait a bit for him to reconnect.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hey,
we just lost you, but now you're back.
So in the magnetized systems, we can describe it using an effective large-scale theory, which is called magnetohydrodynamics, where the length scale of the interest is much larger than the plasma scale. Here, the plasma scale, I include both the plasma gyro frequency and the plasma skin depth. And for the MHD equations to be applicable, it requires two conditions. The first one is the magnetic dominance. So the electrical field should be always smaller than the magnetic field, and the vanishing of the parallel electrical field. When the magnetization is even higher, I mean, approaching infinity, this MHD equations can be reduced to something called the force-free electrodynamics. In that situation, these particles is assumed to follow the field dynamics with the vanishing Lorentz force. And in both MHD and the force-free electrodynamics, the fundamental perturbations of the magnetic field will produce two modes of the waves. One is the alpha mode, and the other is the magnetosonic mode. Okay. And these perturbation of the alpha wave modes, how can they deposit energy to the particle through whatever wave-particle interaction is my main interest. So let's say in the previous few years ago, some people have been studying either the turbulent dissipation and also the relativistic reconnection. And Chris Thompson and I have done a lot of things on the turbulence cascade. And what we found is that the turbulent dissipation timescale acts much longer than the single wave crossing timescale. So here to the bottom left, I show how much energy of the alpha wave can be dissipated through a single collision. You can see like it's smaller than 0.1%, even for the amplitude psi larger to than unity, close to 1, 2, 3, somewhere here. And magnetic reconnection is another mechanism. And for the relativistic magnetic reconnection, it proceeds through the tearing stability that's forming these kind of plasmoid. And then these small plasmoid merge into a larger plasmoid, and these particles accelerate at this X point or Y point. And the relativistic reconnection is found to have a reconnection rate about 10% of the speed of the light, and it can usually dissipate about half of the magnetic energy available. But however, this this reconnection rate is still smaller than the wave speed, which is very close to the speed of light.
So what does the reconnection rate mean? And why is it in units of a speed?
So you can something like this. For example, in these simulations, right? When the people start the simulation, they kind of prepare these reverse magnetic fields in some kind of unstable equilibrium, and then they slowly perturb it. And you can see once the simulation, once the reconnection starts, these energy will be streaming in towards the center at almost the 10% of the speed of light. That's the reconnection rate.
So this is the speed of the magnetic, the plasma, this 10% of the speed of light, or is it the speed of?
You can think of this like for the pointing flux will be b squared over 4 pi times this speed, 10% of c.
Okay, nice. Cool, thanks.
Okay, so now let's consider the problem we are interested in is that we're considering the collision of the two alpha waves. So the setting is that we have along the x direction, we have a uniform background magnetic field, Bx equals B naught. And then we prepare two alpha waves with a perturbed magnetic field along y direction, By. And then there will also be an Ez. So the By for the two alpha waves will have different signs. Okay, so they are anti-aligned. And the amplitude of the wave is just given by the magnitude of By divided by B naught. So if there's no plasma and the wave will propagate as it in vacuum, we can see that from a simple linear superposition at the center, the B field cancels each other, the By cancels each other, Bx is still there, but the electrical field Ez will add up. So in that situation, the linear superposition will give you at the collision center, the electrical field will be in the field and will break the magnetic dominance for the case the amplitude larger than 1/2. And this is usually happening in the force free electrodynamic simulations. And what people do is just they reduce the electrical field by hand and assume there's some undergoing physical dissipation there. Mm-hmm. And that's also this simulations is also a motivation for why we want to study this problem. We want to understand what is the exact physical mechanism beneath it. Okay. So now what is really happening if we have really plasma here? So as these waves go colliding to the center, when they the electrical field is larger than the magnetic field, break the magnetic dominance, the plasma particle fills the electrical field and will be accelerated. And the particles with opposite charges will be pushing in the different direction and induce a current. That current will then in return reduce the electrical field back to some value Ez equals some B naught. So as shown by the blue line here. And this effectively sets a boundary condition at the center. And this boundary condition can be satisfied if two other reflective waves with amplitude A minus one will be reflected from the center. And as we superimpose the reflective waves with the incoming waves, we can see that there's there will be an increase of the magnetic jump just outside this current sheet. So the magnetic field By will increase to 2A minus one here as shown by the blue line. And finally, when the collision is over, the incoming wave with amplitude A will be reflected with amplitude A minus one. So they will be reflected with smaller energy. And the difference between the incoming wave energy and the reflected wave energy will be then deposited to the particles corresponding to a dissipation fraction of the incoming wave F, which will be 2 times A minus one divided by A squared. Sorry, here there's a mistake here. Sorry, here there's a typo here. Okay. So that is how the wave evolves in the wave dynamics with the presence of the plasma. What about the particles? How these particles, what's the particle motion around this current sheet and how they get accelerated and obtain such high energy? And these particles at this current sheet follows something which is a relativistic variation of the Spicer orbit.
May I ask a question? So sure. You have a new component. You have a reflected wave because you have additional induced plasma in the center, right? So does it take time to generate this plasma? I mean, if the duration of this pulse is short.
Yeah. So the idea is that inside the pulse, these plasma will have some drift velocity. So these plasma will be streamed towards the center with the waves. Okay. So as the wave coming in, pointing flux stream in towards the center, it also carries plasma towards the center.
Okay. So you mean it takes no time and...
So the time for the reduction of the electrical field is on the plasma time scale, which is much, much shorter in our case.
Okay.
So let's just come back to this problem about the particle motion inside the current sheet. So the particle by reverse sign with size 2a minus one around the current sheet of the size and delta. So when the particle come into the center, this motion be understood in two different ways. So let me just from one way and then the other. Okay, so the particle first, they see a larger Ez. They will be first accelerated into the z direction in the same as the same direction as the charge times the electrical field, and this vz will then induce a Lorentz force vz times by along the x direction, and such is exactly pointing towards the center if you consider the reverse sign of the by. So these particles is confined at the center with some oscillation around the collision center. However, since there also exists a background BX, these particles, while oscillating, they also gyrate around the x-axis. So then the VZ will slowly turn into VY and then back to VZ with the reverse sign. Okay. So once the VZ reverses its sign, before VZ reverses its sign, EZ times BZ keeps doing positive work to the particle that's accelerated the particle to a very high gamma. However, once VZ reverses sign across the zero, the Lorentz force along the x direction will reverse sign and pushing particle outward. So then the particle will be ejected with the very high gamma with obtained energy. So on the right here, I show a few the evolution of the energy and the velocity for some test particles. And the particles will escape with some energy gain, gamma proportional to the A squared times the initial magnetization sigma naught. And alternatively, you can also view these size orbit as by introducing the incorporating the magnetic fields, the vector potential into some effective potential for the particles. And as depicted on the right, the particle first follow the red trajectories with some kinetic energy, and then they climb up the potential, and then they come back, return to the origin with some oscillations. So because these particles accelerate along the z, it also supports the current. So there will be some kind of self-regularization between that, such that the time for the particle across the current sheet is around the same as they climb up and down the potential, which will finally leading to the central width of this of the current sheet to be something or the order of the particle skin depth, C over omega P. So here, kind of describe briefly. For more detail, you can have a look at my paper. So after we've worked out the analytical predictions, so let's have a look what is really happening with the kinetic simulations. And we use the particle in cell called TristanMP and perform both 1D and 2D simulations. And we are considering our incoming waves is much larger than the particle skin depth. So these waves is about like 3000 times of the particle skin depth. So here I show the three snapshots of the waveform at different times. And you can see like it's in good agreement with our predictions. So wave amplitude with amplitude A coming in is reflects amplitude A minus one. And at the center, E field is dragged very close to the B naught, and the B field will be enhanced to 2A minus one. And during the collision, there's a steady state formed as shown on the left. Here I stack many snapshots of the current configuration JZ and the central magnetic field BY across the current sheet. And the bottom panel, I shows the distribution of the particle density. These particles coming in, they stay a while in the current sheet, forming a higher density, and then they get rejected. And we can see these high density wings are around the current sheet is expanding at some constant rate. So on the right, I plot the evolution of the phase space for the particle and colored by their initial position from the center. So red one means particles sit close to the collision center. So they get streaming to the collision center earlier and then escape earlier. And you can see like these, when these particles come in, they first spend a while at the center climbing up to acquire higher gamma. And then almost they get ejected with almost the same gamma here. Okay. And also, we also perform a few 2D simulations in the XY plane where Y direction is just along the perturbed magnetic field BY here. And here I stack two simulations. The blue line shows the 1D field configuration and the orange line shows the 2D case. And you can see here the wave dynamics is almost identical. So here for the 2D wave profile is this averaged profile along the y direction. But however, if we examine this 2D simulations a bit deeper, we can see that the center the central current sheet, the Terrier instability will be initiated if the amplitude is larger than 2, as we observed in the simulations. So on the left, I show a few snapshots during the collisions, and you can see this initial straight magnetic field lines will become will form this kind of plasmoid and turning BY into BX. This is a clear sign where the magnetic reconnection is taking place, and the smaller plasmoids first form and then merge into larger ones, some big monster plasmoid. So on the right, I compare the snapshots for different amplitude, equals 1, 2, and 4. For A equals 1, there's nothing happening. Terrier instability is not initiated because the background BX stabilized this configuration against the Terrier instability. But for larger amplitude, it can, this situation will reduce to the normal magnetic reconnection. Okay, so here's the final result. Sorry, F is also wrong here. So the fraction of energy dissipated. So the blue cross will be my 1D case. The red circle will be my 2D case. And the dashed line will be my analytical prediction, which will be 2 times A-1 / A². And for A, for the amplitude close to unity equals 1, we see like the efficiency can reaches about nearly 100% for a single on the time scale of a wave collision. And for the 2D energy dissipation, we see for lower amplitude, A smaller than 4 or 8 something, the dissipated energy fraction is almost the same as the 1D case. So even though there'll be magnetic reconnection takes place for A larger than 2, but the dissipation rate is more or less similar. However, for even larger amplitude, as the for the 1D case, the dissipated fraction will asymptote to 0. The 2D, due to the activation of the magnetic reconnection, the 2D case still dissipates about like 20% of the wave energy. I think that's more as I want to say here. So in this paper, we propose a faster dissipation of magnetic energy through the collision of the anti-aligned Alfvén waves. And we found that the 1D simulation agrees well with the analytical calculations. And for the 2D case, it is the same as the 1D case, but as the magnetic reconnection is activated at the collision center, for large amplitude, the magnetic the energy dissipation is dominated by reconnection and dissipates around like 20%. And this mechanism is very fast, acts on the wave crossing time scale, and can be very efficient and can dissipate almost 100% of the wave energy as the amplitude close to unity. And you can operate in many strongly magnetized plasmas, for example, compact objects, black hole jets, accretion disks, and pulsar winds. Yeah, and we would envisage that could have many more applications in the all these systems. Yeah, and one other possible thing I want to say is that is, as we showed that in the 1D case, these particles almost accelerate to the same gamma, which is can also be served as some potential coherent sources for some emissions. I think that's more or less I want to say here. So I'm willing to take any, if you have any questions.
All right, very nice talk. Any question for Xun?
I had a question. Thanks for the nice talk, Xinyu. I was wondering if you could say a bit more about the like particular astrophysical scenarios you imagine these like collision of Alfvén waves operate in. So like is there any, you listed a bunch of them. Is there like one or two of them that you consider the sort of most promising or are there any like particular observational signals that you might go after trying to explain using this mechanism?
Observational signal, I'm not sure. Yeah, but for example, I think the most promising one is the magnetosphere, magnetosphere, like giant flares. Because we know there will be perturbations of the magnetic field lines and launch Alfvén waves. And then through these Alfvén waves, And one thing, one immediate thing is that we can have a very, let me go to this line, as in the fireball model, right? These, through the turbulence cascade, that gonna take many, many wave crossing time scales for the fireball to, for the energy from the waves go to particles and get thermalized to create this fireball. But once we have this, that just acts on the time scale of one single wave crossing. And that because we know that the in the giant flare light curve, there will be a first a very short millisecond rise, and then another kind of a large strong decay for also a few milliseconds. And then there's a longer tail, a few tenths of the seconds and even longer. Yeah, so if we have such kind of collision, the wave crossing time scale on the closed field lines inside here is also the same order of like a few, maybe 10 milliseconds something. So that really requires the energy dissipation on a single often wave crossing. I think that will be my first situation in mind where such acceleration can have an application.
So I guess the one question I have is, so this A was the amplitude of the Alfman wave, right?
Yeah.
And A equal to one, that's a big amplitude, isn't it?
Well, yes and no. So if you, let's come back to this Poisson magnetosphere, this magnetic, the background field strength will decrease as R to the power, 3/2 or 2/3, I don't quite remember, but it just will decrease when it goes away to the center. So even if you initially launch some wave, maybe a relatively smaller amplitude when it's getting away and moving along the background field lines, when it's get closer to the equator, the amplitude can be increased a lot. Yeah.
So how does it increase? Why does it increase?
Because the magnetic flux is constant. The magnetic flux is conserved.
Okay. Okay, I see.
Yeah.
Right. It just okay. So the question is, what's responsible for these waves? What's making these waves? That's I think.
Yeah. I think Chris and I've written, and also Juan has written a few papers about this crustal motion that can excite waves into the magnetosphere. Yeah.
So you think you have crustal motion that launches these waves and then they grow as they travel and then when they collide, then they could-
Yeah, that's one possibility. It's also magnetosphere instabilities. When it disrupts the whole magnetosphere, the global instability, that can also launch many waves in the magnetosphere.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, I have another question just to follow up on this. So how does this depend on directionality of the wave? So you described sort of the waves colliding, right? And so in these giant flares, it's conceivable that you have waves emanating from different parts of like this magnetic flux loop or so on and sort of colliding somewhere in the magnetosphere. But what about other systems where you preferentially don't have like colliding waves, but maybe just waves being traveling in the same direction, but maybe overtaking them? So sort of like a internal shock kind of scenario for gamma ray burst or so. So how would you actually dissipate energies, for example, in jets or so?
Yeah, sure. So the case is we are considering the strongly magnetized system. So the Alfman wave here, we're just taking to be the speed of light. It's almost there, right? So, and then, so when, in this case, when the two waves are moving along the same direction, there almost be no overtaking, they just move together. And then in this situation, when they're moving in the same direction, there'll be no self-interaction. There'll be no way, I mean, either through a turbulence cascade or through such a mechanism like this, it doesn't work. You have to require this counter-propagating Alfman waves.
Okay, I see. Thanks.
So you mentioned about this fast dissipation, right? But this happens, right, when A is tuned to be one. But if A is not one, then the efficiency drops quite significantly, right? Like how, right? Like, but in realistic scenarios, maybe A is not 1, maybe it's 2, maybe it's 0.5, maybe it's 0.2. I don't know. So do you still think that this will be a good way to generate fast dissipation?
Yeah, sure. The case is, so first this mechanism acts as for A larger than 0.5. So if A is smaller than 0.5, there'll be nothing. So the wave just passing through each other. Okay. And so what we are seeing here is that this peak is 100% for A equals 1. For A equals 2, we see about like 50%, I guess, which is still quite large, quite high. Yeah, A equals 2 is like 70% something. For A equals 4, yeah. So, I mean, in the real astrophysical systems, I mean, we are thinking of, especially for the Magneto-Magnetosphere, we would envisage such the amplitude to be something of order unity, not very much, very large or not very small. Yeah, so that's why we are thinking this kind of is kind of promising here. And also again, these also due to the decrease of the background field, there's also some certain range, right? We'll see this amplitude grows to be close to the unity. But in either case, we see like this mechanism is faster than the turbulence cascade and also faster than the magnetic reconnection.
So if you're not colliding equal amplitude Alvin waves, would that be?
Yeah. In the case is, if the two waves, incoming waves, have different amplitude, you can always do a Lorentz boost along the x direction to make them have the same amplitude, right?
Okay. So any other question for Xinyu?
So do you have any plans to put this in like realistic simulations, like force-free simulations?
In force-free, you cannot see it. You have to do it with some kinetic simulations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do have some plan. We launch waves using some kinetic simulations, see what kind of emission it can be produced.
So the interesting thing to simulate would be some sort of a neutron star microsphere with cross dot motion and then see.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
So you launch waves, how these waves accelerate particles and other things. Yeah.
Cool. Thanks.
Thanks, Ash.
Any additional questions? Well, if not, let's thank Xinyu again.
Thank you everybody for listening.